This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Welcome to episode 44 of the All Souls Podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
And I think we have a treat slash guest. I guess they could be both. Today, tonight, this afternoon, this episode. We have here joining us to speak about the next episode. Summer, what episode are we speaking of today?
We're talking about episode 209.
So here to help us talk about 209 is friend of the show and our friend, Dr. Stephanie McGuckin.
Hello.
Well, hello.
Hello. And since we had a little oopsie whoopsie last week with some filey wileys, this is take number 37. We had at least four takes last time, so it's all good. We figured out our humps and bumps. That's on you. Lumps and bumps. There we go. And we're ready to get gurn. Apropos of nothing, it's the time change. I knew that my telephone, all my technology would automatically change, right, with the time. But anything that plugged into the wall that's not, I guess, a smart technology won't. So I have several analog clocks that don't. So those are wrong, but that doesn't matter. They don't wake me up. Although my alarm didn't wake me up either. I have cat automatic feeders and they're all set manually. So yeah, those didn't change either. So a very good likelihood that you're going to hear the cat food machine come on. So there we go. Happy time change to us. So episode 209, we open. It is London, 1591, and Diana is going over the book. It is still spinning for her, still sighing. And she puts it in its hidey cozy.
Worst hidey cozy.
This is going to be a theme of this podcast today, is us just lamenting and otherwise complaining about the worst hiding spot in the history of hiding spots.
For several reasons. Like, there are lots of reasons, because there were lots of ways to have overcome this, and they didn't think to do any of them. One, the light glints off of the floor. It's visible. Like, with the light, the way the light hits the floor in the room.
Well, and it makes noise.
Well, before you even step on it. Yeah. It's visible. You can tell that that was a replacement board on the floor. One. Two, and Stephanie was saying this when we were talking earlier, is that you hear it when you step on it, and it's in a doorway.
It's the doorway that gets me, right?
Well, it's not in a doorway. It is aligned with the doorway. So it's in the path of the doorway, which is the silliest thing. It should have been under the bed at the very least.
The doorway literally frames it. Again, beautiful for camera angles, but like, you can have camera angles that are great for hiding spots as well. Like, we see that.
There is a rug in the room. Why not use it? Why not cover it?
Okay, if nothing else, I don't understand why they didn't put a rug on it. That.
I'm just saying, if it's really that important of a thing to keep hidden, why not actually hide it?
It would have been more hidden under the mattress or under the pillow even. Behind a curtain. Literally anywhere else.
She should have sewn a pocket in her dress and just carried it with her everywhere.
That's a little bit of a big pocket, girl. She's like limp into one side. Come on.
Her skirts are huge.
Have you seen Tudor pockets? You literally stitch them and add them in.
They are the Mary Poppins pockets.
Like, she could have done it. It's not that big of a manuscript.
That's what I'm saying.
So she speaks of staying in that time and, oh, gracious. Matthew then is out ootin' a boot, and he, I wrote at least, it's in his ruff at his finest. Now, I know not everyone's a fan of ruffs in general, but he does look great.
Rough. It looks like a roll of toilet paper around his neck. Like, if you cut a roll of toilet paper in half and made it, you know, large enough to actually go around your neck, it's just, it looks like he's had whiplash and it's a whiplash collar.
Or he's been licking himself.
Oh, like an e-collar.
I was going to say it's like an e-collar, but then I was like, that's what it is, though. I don't know. It's just like,
it is an e-collar.
Well, no, it's not. It's not. It's not.
Summer.
It's not. Elizabeth wears an e-collar. He's wearing a ruff.
Got it.
It's not the same thing.
But they're both Elizabethan. That's what E stands for.
Correct.
For our pets.
But it would be an Elizabethan ruff.
Fair enough. But a ruff is still a collar if it goes around your neck. It's a type of collar. Okay, so He's got it on. He has to go see the queen. And he's all, finish your magic, yo. We need to get. So Goody Allsup's been unwell. And they go to see her. And she comes to life, as she always does, when she sees Diana. And she's brought up to date.
I didn't notice this the first time that I was watching this, or the second time, or the third time. I noticed it today. She's literally fallen asleep in the most uncomfortable looking chair that has ever existed. And when I'm old, I don't want to be in Elizabethan time if that is a comfortable chair. But it's like hard. It's wooden. It's like there's not even a soft edge to it. It's just...
That's what she said.
Exactly.
So she is brought up to date with all their travels, well, on both sides, right? Diana says what they've done, and Goody Allsup brings her up to date with all the witch persecutions, and they are on... those witches are on fire! Okay, wow, I'm on fire today. Yes, Allsup, Goody Allsup, notes that dark clouds around Matthew have somewhat lifted. Huh. But she notices something else. Oopsie whoopsie, she's knocked up. And remember I said they went there, Matthew's with her, because later on he has to go see the queen. But for now, he's with her. And so he hears this, and the look on his face is priceless. It is like the actual pho. And we go into the Pyrex opening.
Like, we need to talk about the whole fact it is Goody Allsup that basically is like announcing their pregnancy. Because like, how has Matthew not noticed? Or if Matthew has noticed, why hasn't he said anything? And there's just so much there that I'm like, why is it Goody Allsup that gets this revelation?
It seems that Diana kind of knew in the last episode, because he's like, is everything okay? And she goes, I don't think so. But, you know, she thinks it's something else. And we know it's not, because, you know, we've read the books. But
it's the Elizabethan cheese.
Exactly. But, you know, I think that it's safe to say that adaptation wise, we're not having a miscarriage. They're only going to have the one baby. This one pregnancy.
In case what Summer just said confuses the poop out of you, no, we're not like giving any foreshadowing. In the books, now that it's passed, well, mostly passed, in the books, she does get pregnant. In book two, she has a miscarriage, but she then maybe something else happened. So we're not going to say anything further. So that's what Summer's referring to. So in the book, there's a miscarriage and they deal with
the aftermath and the grief. And this is a good way to bring it up, to talk about adaptation, because I know we've talked about this offline, is that does anyone else feel like the choices that they're making sometimes don't feel like I feel like they're focusing on the wrong things and spending a lot of time on some things and not leaving us a lot of room to finish.
What Summer is saying is we both stand behind, I think, but what she's alluding to, and I thank her for this because she just reminded me of something we talked about. Since this is like, as I said, take number 37, we know what we hope we remember all the things that we kind of stamped out last time we talked about this episode. But yes, there are things that we will be talking about in this episode, as ever episode, that are interesting choices, or that are a result, that are wonderful things. There are wonderful things, and Summer's not knocking this. There are wonderful things that are a result of what Summer just described, right? We get amazing scenes with great actors and really touching scenarios, but you have to look at what we lose because of that, or at least what's not included or what's not focused on. And sometimes stuff is focused on, I think this is what Summer is saying, stuff is focused on to maybe not the detriment, but to the loss of something else.
Well, it's not only that, but we know the penultimate episode of the season, and knowing where they are, like where they are physically in the book, because, and now granted, this episode we stay firmly in the past. We don't go back and forth into the, and then back into Elizabethan time. But at this point in Diana and Matthew's story, we're only like halfway through the book. Whereas in the future time period, we're closer to the end of the book. So it's kind of jarring as a book reader to try to follow it in a way, and but also realizing, knowing how much they did in Elizabethan London and knowing how much left they had to do book-wise, and knowing there's one episode left to wrap it all up, at least for the season, unless they expect it to kind of branch into the next one. But there's way too much stuff in Book of Life. They can't.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of the things that sort of, I don't know, frustrates me. Frustrates feels too strong of a word about this season, is this, they're fleshing out these points of view like they did in season one, right? And we're seeing more and more of what Matthew and Diana didn't agency in the books. And I like that. But there are moments where this trilogy, this part of the books is about Matthew and Diana. And as much as I love the other characters, like, I don't think anyone is surprised by me being like, give me more Marcus and Phoebe. I love it. There are other scenes and other moments where we get so far away from some of what we know Matthew and Diana are doing that it just, it's like the focus is too uneven. Like, they've not just brought in the POVs to help explain what's going on and to help set up what Matthew and Diana are coming back to. It's just, it wanders in a way, kind of like how that sentence just wandered.
You mean how the way I just like my default?
I love it. It was totally alliterative. It was beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. But yeah, there are just times where I'm like, thank you for giving me this scene. But what about this other thing that happened that has a big impact? And Benjamin Fuchs is a good example of this in the Prague episode, the non-Prague episode, where Diana just meets him quickly. And that's all the viewers get. And like, we get there's unease there, but there's so much more that happens with that scene and that dynamic in the books that I worry about what that's going to mean for Book of Life. And yeah, like, they do come to it in, you know, the last episode, but it's still, there's not that terror and that sense of unease in the same way. And the miscarriage is another example of this, I think, in that I understand why, for adaptation purposes, you would not go there. The show's already dealing with so much stuff that is related to trauma that I can understand why, if you're going to leave something out, you leave that arc out. But it's hugely important for Matthew and Diana coming together as a couple on top of everything else that brings them together and tries to push them apart. And for the audience to realize there's a reason that other creatures don't want them mixing and why magic is weakened, which is a theme that we've seen, why the creatures, actually all of them, are weaker than they were, you know, in the Tudor period that they've gone back to.
I feel like we only have to look at the Habsburgs to understand why everyone's weaker.
Yeah, well, several levels there. But it's sort of taking that out means we lose that sort of discursive element that allows us to explore some of the issues that are at stake. And yeah, they kind of replace it with Baby Margaret in a sense. And some of the conversations around there have just shifted. But that's had knock-on effects that aren't great and seem to go against some of the themes of the show and the books. So it's just, I don't know. And like, again, just to state what Ginger and Summer have said, this isn't, I don't love what they've done with season two, because there are parts that I think are gorgeous and perfect. But there are other moments where I'm like, why? Like, I'm interested in the why that they changed this. And I'll never forgive them for making the snake necklace and then not discussing it. Well, the dragon necklace, and then not doing anything with it.
Well, I may never forgive them for the fiery chicken.
Oh, yes, we will get to the fiery chicken. Poor fiery chicken. Although I will say to the Bad Wolf merch gods, if you give me a fiery chicken, I will buy it. Even as I make fun of the fiery chicken.
You opened up Pandora's box, woman. That is something we don't have time to discuss. But yes, can we just say, not even just to the merch gods, but would they even open a merch anything? They got nothing. And there's so much.
What they need to do? No, we need a hoodie with Korra on the back.
Yes. Can we do it where like the arms are the wings?
Sure.
So she's coming up to surround you like she does with Diana Project.
Hell yeah.
And then can I have a Ashmole 782 journal?
Yes. Oh my God. Could you imagine? It was a palimpsest so that all of the pictures are kind of watermarked on the pages. So it's like you're writing, you're adding your own level to the palimpsest. Oh my God. Why aren't we in charge of merch?
Okay. Who do we contact? Because I now need that in my life and for research books.
It's not only a lost opportunity in obviously them getting boku money. It's also something that, I'm not saying it's easy because that's not my lane. So I don't know what it takes. I know what it takes to do a podcast or two. I don't know necessarily what it takes to have a shop. We have one for our other show that's, you know, we mildly monitor. We have support to help monitor that. But anyway, it's something I'm really surprised that they didn't jump on that during COVID, because there's nothing more that I would have done. Oh, I know that.
There's been a lot going on.
I'm saying, if they had done it when everyone's locked at home and can't go out, and because they couldn't do their premieres, right? They didn't even have a premiere.
If you think about it, one of the issues in merchandising during the pandemic is a lot of the factories and stuff have been shut down. So there was a delay, and I know this was the case for some of the Star Wars stuff. There was a delay and things kind of got out of sync. So I think that could be some of the reason that we don't have merchandise, because like, if you think about the big shows that Sky has had, just talking from the UK side of it, they're not unfamiliar with good merchandise. So that, I mean, it might be like, yes, the pandemic's a great time for it, but it might also be the pandemic might be the answer here.
Yeah. Well then, okay, that I could go with, and I understand if they maybe didn't jump into it season one because they wanted to make sure that there was an audience and everything. Okay, I get it. And then maybe they were gonna, maybe, who knows? I'm talking out of my head here, out of my ear. Maybe they planned something for two, who knows? And then COVID hit, right? So we don't know what they have in the works. It's just that they haven't even like given lip service to anything. Like they haven't even said, don't worry, we got you. There's merch coming.
I am not going to be able to get the idea of a palimpsest journal out of my head.
I know, me neither.
Ever. It's going to live there rent-free for the rest of my life of how cool that would be.
They have given us merchandise books. I mean, so we do have some merchandise and it is a book.
Then we get to the Pyrex opening.
Oh my God, we really only did make it to the opening.
So he's still flummoxed. It's kind of funny. This episode starts with her wanting to stay and take care of Jack. And as soon as she's pregnant, it's all, we're a family. And they need to go back, but, you know, take care of Jack. And Matthew says he will ensure that Jack is well looked after. But for now, he has to go placate the queen.
I know you can't come because sometimes your presence makes things worse.
I feel like they know they're getting close to leaving. And there's part of Diana that just wants to see Elizabeth again because of her historian's heart.
Yes, poor Diana.
And I kind of feel like, poor thing, can't go see the queen one last time. But also, Matthew is 100% right. Like, he is walking into a very tense situation. And you know, Diana would just, she'd say something, she'd do something, and it would be 100 times worse. Or she'd yell at Matthew about what he's doing, even though she would do something worse.
I think this is the point in the conversation in one of the first 36 takes that I said, Diana is similar to Claire in that, but Diana's more dangerous, right? Because if she gets angry, buildings blow up.
No, snakes appear out of shoes and glasses.
Things literally catch fire.
But this is kind of harkening back because I didn't talk about this earlier because I wanted to get to the pregnancy portion before I brought it. In the book, Matthew, with the first pregnancy, Matthew was literally like, you have 7 weeks. 7 weeks to figure this out and get your magic on par with what you need to do because we got to go. That's your timeline. Learn your knot. Whereas this time around, he's just like, we've been here too long. You need to focus on your magic. I'm gonna go take care of the queen and we'll figure this out. So there was a totally different, not just vibe, but a reasoning behind why they had to get the fuck out of Dodge.
And there's like, it's the sense of urgency as well. When you take away that sort of time frame, mm-hmm. you lose the perspective of how long they've been there
yeah.
and why
yeah.
Matthew needs to go take care of the queen. It's sort of like giving a student a homework assignment without a deadline. Just like, go finish your magic and I'm gonna go like do this other thing and then eventually we'll sort it.
So I wrote this and might not remember why I wrote it, but you guys can fill in or not. So I wrote, out with Goody.
They're out with Goody. They're moving to the next place. They have to go find the reed, right?
I guess so. Susanna goes to get the others, to get the other witches to form the reed. Yeah. Then we're in Whitehall on his way to see the queen, to placate her, all that. And on the way, Kit confronts him.
Is lurking in an alleyway. He just happens to be. He's like,
yes, probably a little half drunk or half a sleeper.
Petition to refer to Kit as the lurker because he is king of lurking in this, especially this episode. Even when he's like clearly involved in the scene, he's lurking just a bit.
He's a fly on the wall who kind of slips off the wall and comes in the middle, but he's still the fly on the wall.
I mean, he's really not central to any of the scenes he's in. Like, he's in a scene with somebody else who's clearly the focus of the scene. Like, when it's with Matthew, it's Matthew, right? And Matthew's going to give his diatribe again. I'm nothing without Diana. I'm tired of hearing him scream that, by the way. And then when he's with Louisa later on in the episode, it's all about Louisa. And he's just like trying to get a little word in edgewise the whole time, but he's not really the focal point of the scene ever.
Which is actually very funny because since he's a demon, demons don't count.
Well, and I was going to say, this is his curse. Like, not just in terms of being a demon, but in terms of being Kit. He's never the focus. He's not the center. He wants to be the center of Matthew's attention, and he's not because Diana's there. He wants to be important.
And Shakespeare's there.
And yeah, he's important to us historically, but here, he's not. And so in a sense, they've done that well in terms of the adaptation by always putting him in the center. It's annoying, but it's Kit. And I think even when we talk about Kit, there's a sort of, oh, it's Kit being Kit, and sort of forgiveness for some of his more problematic aspects, even as we discuss them as problematic. But yeah, like you feel bad for him and also are supremely annoyed by him. And he's on this periphery and his curse is that he's never going to get out of it, for Matthew at least. And in some sense in history, because he is overshadowed
by Shakespeare, right? Seriously. But I feel like he's not, instead of the troll under the bridge, he's the demon in the alleyway.
Yeah, he's totally the demon in the alleyway.
Matthew makes it known in his wee sexy tilted hat and his ruff. There is no room for Kit in their relationship, meaning him and Diana. And then we're with Goody and the Reed, and she's like, let's finish these knots, Diana. We gotta go. You gotta get. Diana sees them, the threads. She goes through the knots. And as I said in other takes before 37, I don't know why I always get so emotional as she knots, but I do. Goody is watching and nodding, and this music, dang, that I always like love the music, right? The music makes it to me even more emotional because it kind of just tugs. It's another element of this. And after she gets to knot number 7.
Do you notice that we never see her learning how to do knots? Like, no one ever shows her how the knots are. She's like, just do the knot.
We see her technically learning in 210.
Well, in 210.
She's just that good.
She's just like, okay, get in the circle, do the knot.
One of the things that strikes me about this scene, other than Diana not learning, just doing, is the progression of the colors and the ribbon feature. Because like we talked season one, there was a sort of disappointment in the fandom, especially amongst book readers, that it was spider webs, and not just because we all hate spiders, but because it wasn't these colorful ribbons that sort of foreshadowed her ribbons of the magic. And then here we're getting the threads, we're getting the hint of the ribbons, and as she gets closer to certain things, they get more colorful. So I really love that progression of spidery, webby, colorless to her owning her magic and it becoming more colorful as she does learn to knot without anyone showing her what she's doing.
Now, I have a question for you, Stephanie, because I feel like you read things differently than I do, which means you maintain knowledge of things more than I do when I read. Like I'm a pleasure reader, or you won't know the answer, but you'll have a thought about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the books, she has a physical set of string or threads that she carries with her to practice her knots on. So, and in the book, something happens to those threads, right? So if she's never had threads to disappear and become something else, and she's always only using the threads of the universe, are we going to have the threads become part of her in the next series, do you think?
So my hope here is yes. Practically, if you think of it in terms of an adaptation, this is getting into slightly spoilery territory. So
I know. That's why it was hard to bring it up. But I'm like, I wonder what that will do down the line if we change that adaptation now.
So just spoiler warning, I think if you change it now, from an adaptation standpoint, you don't need it. You don't need to tattoo Diana.
But they didn't put Cora on her. They barely put the scar on her. I think that all of it, and as I listen back now, I think that Deb is like, I want her to be like a sailor under her professor clothes. I want her to be covered in tattoos, right? So because she has so much focus on tattoos in these books that are not tattoos that she went to a parlor and got, they are magically transposed on her skin by the things around her.
Even though we haven't seen Cora on her physically, and we don't have the ribbons physically on her yet, they have gone out of their way to scar her. More so in the first season. From the very beginning, that book stamps her, scars her, which foreshadows what the book actually does in Book of Life. And, you know, upset the entire manuscript studies community because she, like, smacked the book and did all the horrible things to it.
Right.
And then it's this beautiful moment where the book's like, I don't think so. You're not going to hit me like that. And scars her. And it has this wonderful agency. And then Satu's spell permanently scars her. And we do see hints of that in this season. So I think they've set it up where there is an expectation that her body will be changed in Book of Life. Now, whether that means we're going to see the knots or the ribbons become part of her the way that they do in the books, I don't know. I think part of it depends on what their budget is for season 3 for special effects and makeup, but I don't think it's necessary. I think they could do a very interesting something where rather than actually having the tattoos, the scars, the words of the book come across her flesh, they can do the sort of magical aspect, like in that very first episode where it moves across her, but it's not permanent, which is basically what it does anyway. It's always there, but it's more visible at different times when she needs to call upon that knowledge. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw that. Now, personally, I hope we see something with her skin being marked. Because for me, for the sort of art history aspect, the manuscript side of things, that's integral to the story of Ashmole and Diana. Because, and as they say a few times in this season, and didn't really acknowledge as much last season, is the manuscript is made from creature skin, right? We all know this. It's in the books. I've talked about it ad nauseum and can continue to talk about it ad nauseum, but it's important. And I think the book as an active agent, as its own character, is important. And I think if they don't give us some of that tattooing, whether it's from the book or from her magical ribbons, then they've missed it. They've missed the point of some of this queering of manuscripts and of magic that Deb does so masterfully in the book. So yeah, so that was a long way of saying, I hope, and I think they have good justification to do it, but how they do it's going to depend on what they do. Because again, season three is shorter, and some of this is pandemic concern. But if you think of the themes and the complications of book three, it's the most complicated of the trilogy.
Oh gosh, yeah. Oh gosh, yeah.
So let's slowly bring it back to this episode.
We're going so much more off topic this recording.
I know. You know, and I'll tell you why. It's because I just had to watch those two episodes back to back and I have 10 fresh in my head. So I'm having a hard time not bringing in things from 10.
Yeah.
Now, because it's fresh.
Yes.
Okay, then let me help you. After she gets to knot 7, we see Cora. We see Cora. Finally, the thing we've already talked about that hasn't come up yet. We see it's a fire drake. And as Summer says, she looks like a
chicken. But I feel like they really rushed this. Like they didn't explore it. They were just like, look, you have a fire drake. Look, what's her name? Oh, let's move on now. She'll come when you need her. And done.
The force spell. And I feel like we talked about this.
It's like foreskin, only it's magic.
Yeah. The force spell and why it's so important is just, it's totally not there. And if you think going into Time's Convert, like jumping way ahead, we see another one.
Mm-hmm.
And I want an explanation here. And again, I really hope we're getting deleted scenes because there's so much that has to be on a cutting room floor for this season. And I feel like this is a conversation that you would record in an adaptation, that you'd film it, you'd write it, all of that. And then when you're editing down the episode, you chuck it out for whatever reason. And yeah, it's so quick and it's so disappointing because Cora's a fan favorite. And yes, she's gorgeous. Cora's gorgeous. Like, I know we're taking the piss with calling her a fire chicken.
I know.
And I get why that's the visual references, whatever. But I love Cora and I love what we're seeing with her.
Yeah, it's always so emotional. It doesn't matter. In the book and on the show, it's always very emotional for me with Cora.
But also, but look at the other witches of the Reed when Cora shows up. So we don't see it in this episode, but the only other weaver in London is Goody. And Goody's familiar is what's called a fetch, which is basically a shadow person that walks around. So she didn't even get like a magical animal who does weird stuff. She's just got, you know, a shadow that walks around, opens doors, and is basically her butler. But if that's the only familiar they have ever seen in Elizabethan London, and this bitch pops out a fire dragon.
Oh Lord, they would have passed out. Did you just say bitch pops out a fire dragon?
I'm just saying. I'm sure they're like, oh, she's going to get her force spell today. Probably going to get her familiar today. Prepare yourself for another shadow person. Nope. Fire chicken.
Question. And because I don't remember it, so I'm letting you down, Summer, not recalling everything.
Oh, boo.
I know. I'm sorry. Do we get an explanation in the book as to why familiars take the shape they do? Like, why does Goody get a fetch? Why does Diana get a fire drake? I know it has something to do with affinity.
It has to do with their magical elements and their affinities. So because she is fire and water,
she's a fire drake.
Those two, because she's so heavy fire and so heavy water, those are that animal manifests with those two.
And that explains why her character not here yet gets the hybrid creature that they get.
Correct.
Okay, right. It's the elements.
Right.
But and still within that.
What are Goody's elements? Do we remember? I know she I think she said it.
If she's a shadow, then she's air.
Air. That's right. You're right. She is air. That's exactly why.
It still strikes me as interesting that some are getting mythological creatures and some are getting shadows.
Well, I think that when you're hybrid-y, you don't really have much of a choice because they're like, what else in nature can light on fire but also deal with water well?
Trees.
She's had that too. Like she started. Why was that tree not her familiar?
Also, I think you can't have a tree because you do need an animate object, like something.
Oh, come on. They had trees in Lord of the Rings that talk.
Can you imagine, like, every time you needed magical help, a tree appears out of nowhere? Like, a fire drake makes a little more sense.
But what if it's like the giving tree, where it's like, have my apples. Aww. Take my branches. Take my bark. Build a house for me.
In terms of the alchemical imagery of the tree that does also appear during this scene, which, again, fire hazard, because fire chicken in a tree.
Everything's made of wood. And Elizabethan London, everything's made of wood.
Right. The tree is so important. And I wish there was more focus on that in that scene, because in alchemical imagery, the tree comes up and bears fruit. And in the books, there's this beautiful scene where they mix Matthew and Diana's blood. And that's our first hint that it's compatible and could create something. So it's this alchemical tree. And they're like, oh, what happened in this experiment? It's like, you did alchemy. Like, you did it right. That's what happened. And when you see that with Diana's magic, we're getting that hint of some of the stuff in the book that we don't see otherwise in the adaptation. And I just want, like, I want Diana's voiceover to be like, by the way, this tree is foreshadowing that I am going to have a baby, that I am the tree, and things are going to come forth from my branches.
Correct.
Because that's what's happening.
Or it's our family tree, and we're going to branch out and make more trees.
Because they do. Like, that is a key plot point coming up, that they are making their own family tree.
So, we get Cora. But just as fast as we see her and she goes, my name is Cora, and we leave her. She's gone. And that was the sadness of getting Cora. Boom. Next, we're in Whitehall with Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth I. She has a toothache. So this is already not off to a good start.
So is that makeup not only to... I know it's period appropriate, but is that just mostly for... It was her choice to be that clown makeup-y just to make her look younger? Because if that works, I may have to start doing that.
So we know historically that Elizabeth was obsessed with some of the youthfulness, especially in her portraits. Mm-hmm. And it was not uncommon for rulers during this period into sort of the 17th century to have themselves portrayed younger. And if you think in terms of Elizabeth as unmarried, no heirs, it's really important for her to keep that youthful appearance. And it is a form of propaganda. So this idea that, you know, she's putting on these layers of makeup and trying to present a younger face is something we know from the royal portraits. Some of them show her a little bit older, but I mean, if you think some of the later ones are still showing her with the type that is developed. And again, Hilliard's part of that group that's very much developing her portraiture. And I have so many feelings about Hilliard and the way he was treated.
Did someone say this last time, and I'm completely blanking and now thinking this is my original idea, not my original in the world, but watching it and not getting influenced anywhere because I have not read it online. Did anyone else catch that floor was black and white and it was like a chess game?
We didn't talk about that last time.
And she's the freaking queen.
I mean, that's a good...
But it's the floor.
I just thought about that. I'm just, you guys are going off and I'm thinking of...
I mean, it's the floor. But it's also, if we're going to talk about that, are we going to talk about Septuor also being a chessboard on the wall? And Isabeau is a queen in check because she can't go anywhere?
Well, it's also just the floor of the building. Like, I don't think they changed the floor. I think that's just an accidental thing that you can talk about in terms of the visuals. Yes. And certainly there is the element of chess with season one. I don't know how much they're trying to bring that back here, but I see it. I'm not sure if it was like someone went, oh, let's make this a chess scene.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know that it was intended as far, because like you said, that's the way the building was. That was the way the floor was. But I never thought, and even if it wasn't an intent, it's certainly interesting that it looks like a chessboard and we got a queen. It was just, she's the one who makes decisions over life or death of people. So, you know, she checkmates. In this case, I guess you could say he checkmated. But anyway, so yeah, so he's there to see her. She's got a toothache. like, she says that she's really upset because she wanted Kelly, but Matthew tells her Rudolph was not going to part with him. So she orders him to turn over the book. We got your book back. She orders him to turn it over so she can give it back to the ambassador. And he says, unfortunately, we did get it, but it was stolen on the way home.
But the thing is she's never, even if she gives that book back, she's never going to get Kelly back because Kelly isn't even there anymore. Kelly was liberated by Fuchs.
Correct. So she commands Burley to search Matthew's home. And she goes, if you're a liar, liar! Death.
I feel super bad for Burley.
If you flee, your wife will be treated like a witch, meaning killed, basically. And Lizzie is definitely in a tiff today.
Well, I mean, her teeth hurt. Have you ever had a toothache? Have you ever had, I mean, not even just your teeth. Obviously your teeth because it's so close to your brain. So anything wrong with your mouth is so noticeable. But any pain, having any pain in your body gives you such a short fuse. And it doesn't even have to be physical pain. Like, for instance, I was having a conversation with Ginger on the phone the other day, and she was having a totally normal conversation with me, and someone was texting me something that was very pressing that I was just like, Ginger, I can't have this conversation with you anymore because I have to have this conversation and I can't do this anymore because these two conversations are so at odds with each other that I know that we were having a perfectly lovely conversation, but I'm going to shut you down hard right now because I got to go.
So Kit catches Diana walking around and says that, Diana, Matthew's in trouble. Let's go take care of him and save him and find him and blah, blah, blah. So he takes her to a boat and she's like, wait a second. So she wants to go get Gallo Glass and he's like, no, it takes too long. We don't have that time.
Come with me, the crazy demon who has no special powers except for writing plays.
Come with me, who has been nothing but rude and awful to you. Like, I'm going to play on our shared love of Matthew, but I'm also going to try to kill you.
Come with me and you'll see and out of your imagination.
It happens in the book, right? We know she goes off with Kit. We know that it happens. We know that it's canon that she goes off with Kit. But in the book, she goes off with him in the same location where they already were. So it's not like they were going from one location to another, because that's kidnapping number one. Never go to a second location, because if you go to the second location, they're going to kill you. So she was not paying attention to, you know, the safety classes in elementary school. But in the book, it's all on the grounds of the palace where they are. And he takes her to another section of the palace. So it's not like he's saying, get in this boat and let's go down the river and go someplace new. It was a weird adaptation choice. I know they couldn't. I mean, what they did was a lot easier than setting up a jousting match. So I get that. But going to a secondary location is never a good idea, Diana.
And at their home, the search has begun. Back in Whitehall, Matthew has left the Queen's presence. He goes back, though. He's going to tell her the truth, he says. Back at the house, they find nothing. And Burley's all, check again! And then Burley himself stumbles upon the loose floorboard that's in front of the door, in front of the window, in the path of the light. With the loose floorboard. And he finds the book, of course. So he gets it up, as well as every book in their house. And as he takes it, as Burley leaves the house.
He takes it. Mm-hmm. Everything you're saying is sexual right now, Ginger.
As Burley leaves the house with the book and all the things, Gallo Glass confronts him. He finally shows up and he confronts him. He's like, hey. And Pierre shakes his head. He's like, nah, don't get involved. So he steps aside and lets him go. Good choice, Gallo Glass. Back in Whitehall, Matthew and the Queen. Now this scene, and this is what we were alluding to, or I think Stephanie or Summer was alluding to early on, because in our take 1 through 36, we did have an allusion, and we kind of sprinkled it in there. But here we were able to, oh my goodness, keep it to one place. But we definitely alluded to it, I think, early on in the conversation of things that they focus on, right? The choices they make, what to focus on, and then, which is great, we love it. But to the detriment of what? To the loss of what? And this is one of the things in our earlier takes. We're trying to make sure we hit all the points that we spent a decent amount of time on, because while none of us hate this scene, we all love this scene. It is probably one of the best scenes of the entire series. But Summer had stuff to say, but I think Stephanie had a little more to say. As we talk about this scene, and it's not nothing we say about what we might have missed is any knock to this scene, because this was crazy interesting and one of the best, I think, honestly, probably one of the best acted scenes thus far. We haven't seen season 3, but in season 1 and 2. Anyhow, so Matthew goes back to the Queen, and I wrote, this is probably the most effective in the entire season. She knows about him. Of course we know this. She knows he's a creature. She speaks of creatures. She says something about your witch. So she knows about creatures. That's not a surprise. He doesn't, she says, he knows he doesn't have to hide things about being a creature around her. And the way she looks at him, full of trust and full of pain and full knowledge of her own mortality. The queen is the queen, obviously. She is the figure, the historical figure of QE1, but she's also, in a way, you could say, all of us, in that she is someone who, like we all will, who is facing, and we will all have to face, our own mortality. And so she's struggling, or always is a struggle. Gosh, I would not want to be in her place, right? She's got literally the world, her empire on her shoulders. And so she may have dreams to live, you know, forever. That's one thing, but I don't think that's the main pressure point, the main through line of what she wants as far as why she wants immortality. She has always, and this is something that we know just from history, if you've read about her, right? She has said, like, England is her spouse. Her empire is her spouse. And she is so worried that it will collapse at her death because she has spent so much. She has given her life, and it has been such a struggle to keep things together, to develop them. And so that is her, I believe, biggest worry and fear that she has. Not necessarily that she's going to die, but that at her death, England might. What will happen to England? And so she says to him, your blood could make me immortal. And he goes, and he knows, they probably had this conversation before too, or something along those lines. And he says to her, altering the English succession by placing a creature on the throne, as I told your father before you, would lead to chaos. And then here we get evidence of her, of what I said she's worried about. She says, my death would lead to chaos. Now, she's actually not 100% wrong. Which makes it even more touching, right? It makes it even more like we get it. Number one, we get the humanity. We get her humanity and her fear of death or whatever that may be. We also get, although we cannot understand, the fear for her country. And she's not really wrong, as I said. But yeah, and I think Stephanie pointed out, sorry to steal your thunder, Stephanie pointed out one of the times we discussed this was that having that line in there about, as I told your father, is such, oh, it's like, talk about weaving, right? A weaver, and Deb and the producers include weaving that into this conversation just brings us back to how long Matthew has been around and how much, like, he is a link to her father even.
I just want the blooper reel of him sticking his finger in her mouth.
So she wants, as I said, she wants it for herself. I do think that, but she also wants it for her country. He tries to placate her. And one thing he can give her is a little bit of new knowledge. He says, look, Diana, my wife, is a time spinner. It takes her a second, but she does believe him. And he says, your true shadow, meaning the person you are familiar with that you've known up until very recently, your true shadow would not have disappointed you so, meaning maybe lost Kelly, or not brought Kelly back, or, you know, not done the witch thing in the beginning, or, you know, he did kill him, but you know what I'm saying? He would have maybe continued to torture him, the dude who's killed early, like in episode one or two. He recognizes that he's fallen short in her eyes of what the original Matthew of that time did and does. And so he recognizes that, and he wants to let her know that he recognizes that. And it's more evidence of him being different, and it helps her. She's like, yeah, you're right. So that kind of all comes into the ball of yarn, ha ha ha, or thread, whatever, that, you know, it's made more believable, or it makes it easier to believe that Diana is a time spinner, or by believing that Diana is a time spinner makes it more believable, understandable why Matthew is so different, because he's not of this time. And her realm, the information he gives her is that her realm is secure. Her name will be well known 500 years on. And she thanks him for this knowledge. And as he leaves, he calls her Bess.
As opposed to, you know, Lizzie, like he did in the book. I know that Bess was also another nickname of Queen Elizabeth. However, in the book, I think he very clearly called her Lizzie because there was a character named Bess who was one of her ladies of the court or whatever, who gets impregnated by Raleigh, I believe. Was it Raleigh?
Yeah, it's Raleigh, because we don't get Dudley in this. So, yes.
The first thing he does when he walks into that room is prick his finger and put it in her mouth. And that sounds real gross when I just say it like that. And he also misses, by the way, because he gets the blood all over her lip. In the next cutaway, when they go back to her face, it's not there. So I don't know if they're saying, if they want me to believe continuity-wise that it just absorbed into her skin like magic, which it could have, or they liked that scene of him sticking his finger in her mouth the best, and then the picture of him taking his finger out from the other one better. So I don't know. I'm just saying. I want the outtake. And then he goes on to tell her, because then she says, your blood could make me immortal, which starts the whole conversation about how father, and everything else. And
so she is a toothache. He helps her out by sticking her one.
Yep.
And then,
you know what's better than clove oil, bitches? Vampire blood.
So, okay. So, yeah, let's spend a few minutes talking about the whole Lizzie, whole Elizabeth thing. Stephanie and Sam, what share with our listeners what you guys loved, but also what your concerns were and are.
I think my favorite thing about the way that they've used Elizabeth in this is just, I love how exhausted she is and just how everything about being a monarch in that time period and not really caring about herself, like even her want for immortality when she discusses it has nothing to do with her. It's not that she wants to live forever. It's that she, and at least the way that they are portraying her in the show, is that she fears for the future of her country. And she's like, what will happen if I'm not here? And you feel bad. Why? I feel bad for monarchs forever entertaining having creatures as part of their court, because they will always have it dangled in front of them and they will never be able to utilize the tricks and tips that they could give them, because they can't. They are forbidden by the congregation and everything else from interfering in human politics. So it almost seems rude to even go into that, because all they're going to do is spend the next, 90 years saying, no, sorry, I can't do it. No, but watch me not age. I'm a dick.
Well, but I think within that, creatures have to, because if you think, especially at this moment in time, witches are being hunted and everything else is just one step away. So I think with the covenant and with the knights and Philippe's grand plan of things, is you're always adjacent to it for survival, for protection. So it's very problematic. I think you're right there, Summer. It's one of those problems that you almost have to accept and then reason with the ruler, because as Elizabeth waves in front of Matthew, you cross me, I know what you are, and I'll make your wife, who is a witch, pay for it, even knowing how powerful your family is and how much I don't want to do that. And even knowing that, like, the witches are also important to her and helped her in her passing, that I can't remember if that's said here or in the books. So there's a tension there.
With the storms that kept the Spanish away, is that what it was?
Yes. Which is considered, I mean, even now, that's Elizabeth's moment. That is what makes her queenship successful in some ways and is what makes her ultimately Gloriana. And I love the way that Matthew gives her that surety of like, yes, I know you're worried about your kingdom, but don't, because it will be okay. It survives. And you're remembered as the queen, as Gloriana. And I love the way the music and the camera angle all come together here. It is some of the best acted, best scored, just best scenes of the season. But ultimately, it doesn't do anything for the narrative.
No.
I love this moment. And I love that we're seeing Elizabeth's arc here. And I think some of this is a nod to Deb and her historical interests and her specialty. And I love that she's getting this, because as a historian, as an art historian, there's something quite special when your research shows up on screen, whether it's your personal research or just your area of interest, because it does give you new light. And I've always said that I think some of All Souls is Deb, especially Shadow of Night, is Deb working out her research questions in a way that you can never prove, but you can speculate. And it opens up new dialogue and new questions. There's a reason that there's a lot of us historians, art historians, scholars generally, that are attracted to this narrative. And I think it's for moments like this. But at the same time, what does this do in the story? It lets Matthew save Diana. It creates a loophole for the book to be stolen and returned. So we get reminded of Jack's ability to get himself into trouble, or almost get himself into trouble, with pickpocketing. But ultimately, it doesn't push the story forward. It doesn't create a dialogue that lets us play with some of the themes of the story that other scenes and other things in the book, if given more attention, would have. So, like, I appreciate the nod to everything in this scene, and I love it so much that I don't want them to delete it, but I want something else as well.
My only thing is that as time walkers, I feel like they're giving away everyone's futures. As much as they talked about how they are not going to change the past, all they're doing is changing the past. Like, they're giving everyone their futures for good, for bad. Like, that's their get out of jail free card, is like, I know your future, you want me to tell it to you?
And that seems problematic in terms of, you know, they literally have someone in the present cleaning up their messes in terms of, you know, Marcus watching for things coming up on the auction, the letters, and there's just so much material culture that is a byproduct of their time walking, that when you start telling these historical facts, how much of it is influencing or how much of it is changing? And it's just the time travel paradox of what are you allowed to do?
And what have you always always done, which is the actual time travel paradox, right? Because if all things being relative, and Ginger's going to shut me down as soon as I start saying this, but if they always went back, which they had to because that piece was in Sophie's family. So if they always went back, they always changed those things, did they not?
Yeah, I guess so. There is that sort of...
So if that's the case, then you shouldn't feel bad about trying to change anything because you always changed it.
Right. So what's the entire point of having these guidelines or these self-imposed rules if you...
Like I said, Ginger usually shuts me down before I get this far. So I don't know what to do with all the silence from her line.
So back at home, Diana isn't home. Galaglass and Pierre have gone to get her from Goody Alsop, but she ain't there either. Matthew finds the missing book. Jack has saved the day. He stole it back when Galaglass had stopped them, right? Galaglass then arrives. Apparently,
good to have a pickpocket in the family.
Wires were crossed regarding Diana. Yes, she's lost, but don't worry. She's got a fire drake.
Okay. Question. If she's always escorted from there to home, why didn't she wait at Goody's until Galaglass showed up to pick her up anyway? Because that's a little adaptation loophole that they've forgotten about. Because if she's always escorted someplace in Elizabethan London, either by Galaglass or one of the other men, and this one time, like, did she leave early? Did she just decide she was done tying knots for the day? And they were like, man, we're tired. Go home, Diana. No, don't wait for the guy that walks you home. Just go. If she had waited and been escorted from Goody's, like she's always escorted by either Matthew or one of the other men, then she would never have been set upon by Kit and gotten into the waterway and started that whole thing, which is, I'm sure, exactly why they had her walking by herself. But that doesn't make sense because she never walks by herself.
Okay, but here's the thing, though. Diana's not supposed to walk by herself. Does that stop her from walking by herself or going? Like, and it doesn't, and we know it doesn't, because she follows Sophie at night at the start of the season.
She's in her nightgown,
which is, like, definitely no-no. And we know that she slips... in the book, at least, her guardians. There's a moment in 210 where she does it again. So, like, there's these... On one hand, I'm like, yes, she should have just waited. But again, it's Diana. She's not going to wait when she doesn't want to. So maybe Galaglass was supposed to be there at noon and she finished early. So she's going to be like, I'm just walking down. It's fine. I know these streets. I've been here a few months. I've studied them.
She's just being Claire here.
So, like, she's just being Diana here.
Female character out of time.
Chaos monster.
Yeah, exactly. She's a trope at this moment, at least.
So, Kit, meanwhile, takes Diana to an empty, dripping cavern of a place, and Louisa arrives, choking her from behind.
Which still boggles. It still boggles that, well, she would ever go there with him. Because one, if they're really in a dungeon, if she has him in a dungeon, dungeons are guarded. They walked her into a ruin that is clearly not guarded because they wanted privacy to kill her, right? Or privacy to kidnap her and put her on a boat. Like, it was not a guarded place. So she should have had so many red flags that should have stopped a common person. Now, are we supposed to go on the belief that she's so worried about Matthew's safety that she's not paying attention to literally anything?
Yes.
Okay.
So that happened. Louisa has tricked Kit into getting her because what she had told Kit was that they would get her and exile her on a ship, send her away, but she wouldn't die. But now Louisa's all, yes, my pet, or no, my pet. Sorry, I lied to you. She ain't gonna be exiled. She must die.
And this is when I wonder why Kit believed Louisa in the first place. Because any interaction with Louisa should tell you that she's a little not right.
She cray cray, y'all. I mean, we know she's got blood rage, one. So she doesn't have a good handle on her impulse control. And we know that she's also a little bit crazy, just, you know, in person. So those two as a combination are not great for a co-conspirator or like your sidekick. I would not want her as a sidekick.
So Matthew is going out with Galaglass to look for Diana. Back with Diana. Diana tells Louisa that she's Philippe's bloodsworn daughter. She's like, huh? Now you gotta say, yes, she touches her and she feels it and she's like, oh my God! As a vampire, maybe she's out of her rage-induced mind, but wouldn't she have smelled it already? Wouldn't she have already known? Come on.
She should have, because like anyone else said, it's, especially now, it's real loud. It's a real loud blood vow, right? So it's fresh. So it should be completely noticeable.
Yes. Oh, yeah, exactly.
But I think she's just so focused on what she wants right now that she ignores it and she bypasses it. And even once she notices it, it's not enough to stop her.
That's true. It doesn't stop her. But what it does do, actually, that's true. So what it does do, it not only doesn't stop her, it makes her more intent on hurting her or killing her because now there's an extra reason to do so. If you got this from Philippe, obviously you bewitched Philippe. So it's actually added to her list of sins, crimes, whatever. So she lets, quote unquote, makes Kit take the first shot. They're going to shoot her. Diana, pleading with him, gets him not to shoot. And then Louisa knocks him out. As Louisa shoots, she misses.
It's the only time in history that knowing a poem has ever saved anyone's life.
So as she shoots, she misses. So she tries again. And in the middle of all this, I still don't know what took her so long, but she finally.
She didn't miss. I think her gun misfired. I don't think she missed per se. I think her gun backfired.
The shot misses. The bullet does not hit her. And I don't know what took her so long. As soon as someone pulls out a gun, I'm calling on Cora. I don't care. I'm not waiting until you miss it and pull to shoot me again. So she calls on Cora, finally. Cora comes out, plays the area with fire, and then gets to the ground and absolutely looks like a little hopping. She looks so small, too. Diana tells them, the two of them, Kit and Louisa, that they will die soon and their deaths won't be gentle. At about this time, Galaglass and Matthew arrive and they're going to be taking care of Kit and Louisa.
Well, and they were really nearby. So I think Matthew was close enough to hear her say, you'll be dead soon and your passings won't be gentle. And Matthew's like, got it, on it. But she's like, no, dude, that's not what I meant. History will take care of them. You don't have to do it. But Matthew's like, I'll be their death. That won't be gentle. And I've got a pass to Bedlam because apparently I know people and I can hang out there.
I'll give them a little bit of foretaste. Back at Whitehall, Burley tells Queen Elizabeth that they got every book. And she's like, bitch, please, Matthew's forgiven. Leave me in peace. And the final note that in that scene, it sounds like it's coming home. And I think I don't know if I thought of the term. I definitely didn't think of the term when I wrote my notes moons ago, but now I know of the word. The music resolves. And when music doesn't resolve, it leaves you like, oh my gosh, finish. It's like someone finishing a really well-known phrase or finishing a song or the line of a song. You're like, oh my God, just finish it. I can't stand it.
It's like that scene in Shakespeare in Love when they go, the show must, and then pauses. And then the guy goes, go on.
Yes. No, because what I'm saying is when it doesn't happen, it leaves you, at least it leaves me like, oh my gosh, stop it. Like stab my ear because I need to have this. Your body, your brain expects this resolution because that's what music has. It resolves. I think it was probably a perfect, authentic 5-1, I think, cadence. I could be wrong. Y'all music people tell me, but it sounded like it's the strongest resolutions are perfect, authentic, as I understand, 5-1. There are other strong ones. There's Plagal 4-1, and then there's one you can end on 5.
You've lost everyone.
5 is authentic, but perfect, authentic is 5-1. Anyway, it means finishing on the tonic. Okay, anywhoozle, that's what I heard, or that's what that final note or chord sounded like. And to me, not only was it beautiful, but when you come home, that's what the tonic is, right? It's the home note of your chord or of your scale, whatever your tonic is, whatever key you're in. The tonic is the bass note of the scale. And when that happens, when you come to the tonic or when you land on the tonic and you resolve in 5-1, it is literally coming home. You are literally coming home to rest on the tonic. And so when that happened in this scene, to me, I put that together with what was happening with the actor or the character. She is at peace. She's accepted her fate. Matthew has given her this gift.
She's like, and now I can die.
No, and now I can tonic.
Stop saying tonic.
Back at home, she wants to check on Matthew. Diana does. She has Galaglass take her to Bedlam. She's like, I need to go check out.
Not bed. I would have had him take me to bed, not Bedlam, but that's a whole different show.
That's called a whole different fanfic. Matthew is in full blood. When they get there, Matthew is in full blood rage mode. Still, Louisa tries to instigate him. She doesn't stop. Diana comes to him and calms him, saying that, Matthew, things have changed. I'm with you. I'm your wife. You are not this man anymore. And she says, think of our baby. Now, in this scene, I remember talking about this last time. In this scene, and probably not the first time, because I'm not always, while I hear music, I don't always see light or see things visually. I think I pick up on music or aural cues more than I do on the more blatantly obvious to most people, visual cues or visual sets or blocking. And that is, in this scene, he is 100% with Louisa. He's in the dark, right? It's very shadowy. It's very dark. This whole show, just like Outlander, is quite dark because sometimes you need to turn your brightness up on whatever device you're using just to kind of see things. And he's in full dark or in shadow. Shadow. And she's sitting there telling him and calming him, look, I am with you. Remember, things are different now. Think of our baby. And as she talks, looks, she is in the light, probably daylight, but representing daylight, but she's in the light and he's in the dark. Now, I love this play on light, but as she talks to him and kind of talks him down, they walk out and yes, Bedlam is like mostly dark, right? I just love their scene. He's mostly right? But she's calm, which we know she has, she's been calming on him always, but playing this up with dark and light or shadow and light, just absolutely beautiful.
Well, she's calling him back.
They hold hands, and as they do a lot of times, they go on in to check on Jack.
And then they lay traumatically on their bed together.
They lay in bed, finally. And he says to her, "Every day of my life is a battle for control, a war over the need to possess you in ways, ... And he wants to cleanse himself. So he is like feeling, you know, just having come from this blood rage, having come from, I almost said knocking her up. Not, well, he did that, but not Louisa. Knocking around Louisa and Kit a little bit, but Kit can't take as much as Louisa can. He wants to cleanse himself of this. This is that scene that if you listen to our interview with Rob Lane, it's the scene of the never-ending orgasm. So this is the time when they first drink of each other. So, okay, he has drunk from her neck, right? Or her side of her head. Side of her neck, but he has not. And he's, of course, he's drunk from her wrist when she, you know, literally saved his life. But that was to save his life. And yes, he's seen stuff, but he has not seen everything. And he has not drunk from her in this sexy time way that he would of a mate as a vampire. And so she like gives him her neck and he's like, no, actually the heart vein, you know, your tit.
Because I want to breastfeed again. And that's what we do. It's all about getting back where they started.
So he drinks from her. And while he does that, she has her never ending gobstopper. And then she gives him a witch's kiss and he gets a never ending gobstopper.
It looks like that scene reminds me of like that spit, that drool spit when you kiss somebody and you pull apart.
And after they dig into each other, mentally, visually, whatever, he says, "What did you find?" And she says, "You, only you."
This is the best song that Rob Lane has written this season, 100%. It's so pretty. It is romantic. It also, it highlights some of my favorite instruments, like the strings section. I love a good string section. And it's part of why I love the Bridgerton soundtrack, is because of all of the adaptations of current music.
Look, people rag on that, but I don't listen to a ton. No, I love it. But people rag on it, not because it's not nice, but because they're saying it's these da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- ish, but because it's Taylor Swift, Ariana Grande, and the thing is, I could not sing those other songs. I have yet to listen to any of the music from Bridgerton that I recognize as someone else's. And what does that tell you? It tells you I don't listen to popular music. It's just not my thing. And that's okay. But I think if I had, then I would be like, oh, that's funny. You know, I might laugh, but I would never look at it as like, look down on it.
I think the other reason that I like that this is my favorite song of this season is because it's one of the only songs that he's written for this season that does not resolve into the main theme.
True.
Which is necessary when you're writing for a series because you need it to be familiar. You need it to come back home and set the tone that's already set. However, with this, he was allowed to not have to dive back into the main theme, which you hear a lot of in this whole series. But I find that is probably the challenge to writing for a multi-season series is you have to keep it new, but also familiar.
Yeah, you have to keep it new, but also not.
And that, y'all, is episode 209. One more episode, and I don't know how they're going to fit it all in. I feel like it's just going to be a montage.
Thank you, Miss Stephanie, Dr. Steph, for joining us.
Why don't you come back and do 210 with us, Stephanie? You available?
I mean, we'll have to see.
We'll have to see. Well, you look at your calendar. I'll look at my calendar. We'll confer offline and figure if we can make it work. But we want you back.
Thank you, everyone, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.